This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Mark Bennis, and he's written a soundtrack for Lamplight City. It's this incredible detective adventure, very atmospheric game. And Mark, I'm really looking forward to talking with you and digging in and talking about your music.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on the show.
The premise of the game is so interesting, and the setting too. I mean, it's got just buckets full of atmosphere. It's set in a fictional mid-19th century English town, New Britannia. Mm-hmm. And I love the setting of it, and it must have given you so many directions to take the music.
Oh, absolutely. When I first encountered the project, I met the developer Francisco at an expo, and you know, when I first saw the art, it absolutely draws you in. The setting and the world building, I think, is one of the strongest parts of the game, and absolutely served as a jumping off point for me as I tried to figure out, you know, what Lamplight City sounded like.
Yeah, I bet, because there have been other games that have been set in, well, a slightly newer, like end of the 19th century setting, like Assassin's Creed Syndicate and Dishonored. But this is a little bit earlier than that. And yet you've managed to really capture with your music the darkness and the griminess and people looking over their shoulders all the time.
Yeah. The palette was absolutely one of the most important decisions, I think, that I had to really make in the process of writing the music. And you know, like you mentioned, like Dishonored and you know, Assassin's Creed, a lot of games have breached into this kind of world and setting, but I wanted to take it in a unique direction, or in a way that fit the game and also said something new and different, you know, about this style.
Yeah, because what's interesting about it is you clearly didn't lock yourself in to music that only sounded like it could have been written in the mid-19th century.
Right.
You really expanded it. In fact, there are a lot of cues that date from or sound like they're much newer than that. So
yeah.
What kind of guidance did Francisco give you for the music?
It's actually interesting. When we first started talking about what we wanted the music to be, I remember the first ideas we had were the whole score being a string quartet, you know, a more intimate and, you know, less varied palette, but something that could really, you know, capture the emotional side of the soundtrack. And I quickly realized that Lamplight City it called for more than just, you know, a small ensemble like that. And from there, I started thinking, okay, like what other colors are speaking to me? And I really tried to dig into, you know, the art and what I would hear in this city if I were, you know, literally just walking around it. And I thought of like, oh, okay, like there's definitely like lamps, so there must be, you know, like a triangle for like flickering, or like a piano, and introducing textures like a harp and, you know, a hammered dulcimer. Thank you. to me, the sense of modernness comes more from not restricting myself to that, you know, Victorian style that it's easy to get locked into if you take the setting too literally.
Yeah, I was talking with Austin Wintry about Assassin's Creed Syndicate, and he said he didn't feel like he was really tied to the 19th century either, because the game is giving you so many cues and making it so obvious that that's where you are, that that actually gives you a lot more freedom to sort of cross different eras and stuff.
Right, yeah. And I think part of that is you don't want to necessarily limit yourself to, you know, a palette. You know, you want to feel free that you can explore certain directions if the hammer dulcimer is calling to you. You know, sometimes you got to answer that call. But something that I found very interesting in the whole process of coming up with a palette is if you listen to the soundtrack, you'll notice actually that there are no woodwinds on the score. And part of that was the idea of introducing limitations into the score. I'm sure a lot of other composers you've talked to, you know, speak about this, where if you have everything in the world, it's almost less inspiring because you just don't know what to do with everything. But for me, like focusing the palette and saying, okay, like what creative things can I do without woodwinds was almost a big part of how I landed on some of those sounds.
Yeah, it's interesting because you would think that having access to, well, dozens, if not hundreds, of sample libraries and all the musician friends you have and stuff, that that would make it easier. But I have heard from a number of composers that once they sort of put themselves in a box or they kind of define what the sound is going to be, then it's easier. But even with that, where did you start? Because there are little fragments of melodies and beautiful sounds and kind of tremolo strings and that kind of thing. But what in particular kind of got the ball rolling for you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it came from my talks with Francisco, the developer, about, you know, what is at the heart of this story. And to me, the real heart is it's a story of love between Miles Fordham and his partner, Bill. And when I say love, I mean platonic love. I mean a bond that goes beyond, you know, life, because obviously Bill dies in the prologue of the game.
And, in the tutorial.
Yeah, you jump into it real quick. And to me, it's like the heart of this is this relationship between these two detectives. And I wanted to write in a way or use leitmotifs and themes in a way that would support this story. And one of the big themes that you can hear in the title screen and various other tracks was a motivic way to keep everything together. And in a way, I think that's what keeps the whole thing together, is thinking about it in terms of themes and trying to create some kind of consistency, which is really hard in the beginning process.
Yeah, I can imagine. And the way you worked out their relationship is really interesting, because you used a harp, which I think is, it works so well, because if you think about, you know, the way a harp is constructed, there are strings like right next to each other and they vibrate sympathetically and that kind of thing. So that was a really interesting choice.
Yeah, yeah. And something you hear, you know, with the harp specifically is a cliche of it being attached to romantic love. You know, the idea that, you know, when these two characters are about to kiss, you hear like a glissando on the harp and then the high strings start soaring. And to me, I wanted to take this idea of the harp representing love and move it in a different direction. So, you know, I have the harp representing the relationship between Miles and Bill, the partners, but I actively, you know, avoid using the harp whenever Miles and his wife Addie are in the same room, or specifically like the Addie's theme in the soundtrack. I actively said no harp there because I don't want to rely on that cliche. You know, I think by not doing that, I found, okay, let's try to represent this really strong character, you know, in a different way and show it with, you know, a soaring brass melody and glockenspiel.
And that's such a beautiful melody. And it's so fitting for her because it really feels like she keeps him grounded. She keeps Miles grounded and making sure that he doesn't like go off the rails, which I think is probably a full-time job for her.
She does. She sings. She's a hairdresser. She tries to keep Miles in line. She's the real hero of this story, if we're being honest.
Well, one of the things that makes playing the game so interesting are all of the non-playable characters, all the people you come across, and they run the gamut from all different cultures, races, and financial backgrounds, and it really makes this feel like a believable place. And so as you were working on the game, was Francisco, you know, feeding you more and more information so that this was like you're sort of growing the game together?
Yeah. He shared a lot about his writing process with me and, you know, what he was thinking about the arc for certain cases. And certainly just from talking to him about the story, like the social mobility aspects, the racism, all the issues that you see in this game were absolutely intentional. And I think that's one of my favorite things about what Francisco has created here. Obviously it takes place in this fantasy world, you know, that's hearkening to a time, you know, hundreds of years in the past, but it still has so many issues that I think are like scarily relevant to our current times. And, you know, I think a game that acts to serve more as just entertainment, but as art and commentary is something, you know, any game would be happy just to even dent into. And I think Lamplight City does a great job of that.
Yeah, I think so too. And you get to explore, because of Miles's detective work, you get to explore some really interesting areas and meet some interesting people too, like the Voodoo Queen, whose son is under investigation. And that's a really interesting interlude.
Right. I'm glad you brought the Voodoo case up, because that's a great example of how stereotypes, you know, in the game and in the world at large kind of work, in that the accused murderer, Albert Martin, who's the son of the voodoo doctor, voodoo witch. there's a better word for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's ultimately innocent, but he's portrayed as this, you know, criminal because of his background, because of, you know, his race, because of his background as a voodoo practitioner. And to me, that's really getting at the heart of, you know, a bigger issue. Another interesting part of it was trying to portray voodoo as not an evil, you know, religion, because I think a lot of people, when they think of voodoo, like a certain style of music comes to mind, you know, and, you know, something that sounds a little bit menacing. You know, I started researching the track for the residents of the mother, and, you know, I did the stereotypical, you know, like voodoo music, you know, and you get a lot of, you know, tribal music, and then there's the stereotypical stuff. And to me, I was like, no, I just need to push that away. And I thought about textures. I thought about keeping it within the world rather than pushing this kind of social stereotype, because that's not what the game is doing. Why should the music be doing that too, you know?
Yeah, and the cue that really, I think, really shows that off is St. Roach's dog is barking.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it has such a really cool kind of handcrafted feel to it, with the hand percussion and the melodies that are just a little bit off and a little bit, you know, to make you a little bit uncomfortable, like you would be as Miles talking with someone with this background that he's never encountered before.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, and I like that you say a little bit off, in that the whole case in the first case, there's a leitmotif that goes through a lot of the tracks. It's basically EGFD. It plays a part in the story. I'll leave it at that. But to portray the voodoo music as the innocent type, I slightly altered that leitmotif to EGF C sharp to portray that, like, the voodoo Albert Martin's not guilty, in that, like, this leitmotif, you know, is associated with guilt in a way. And definitely the slight changes are what I think add a lot, you know, to the subtlety, even if you're not totally conscious of it. I think a lot of composers are actively thinking about ways they can infuse these subtleties into their music, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And even if you don't have a music background, if you've played the game up to that point, you kind of have a sense of how the music sounds, and then to get thrown this little curveball. You're kind of aware of it without even really knowing how it was put together and what the mechanics were. So that was very cool and very subtle. And well, the other motif that kind of runs through is the English folk melody "Down Among the Dead Men."
Yeah.
And it turns up, little fragments of it turn up in lots of different cues, but there's one in particular where it's played on the organ in a major key, and you have a great story about what a challenge that was.
Yeah, the way it pops up in the game is Tom Puffin, an organ player at one of the cathedrals, is practicing this choir arrangement of "Down Among the Dead Men." But when you walk into the area, he's practicing it very badly. So I had to figure out a way to reproduce it in a bad way that sounded believable and good and didn't take me 8 hours of moving MIDI notes, you know, in a precise way. Like, I wanted to make it sound believable and real. So I ended up, you know, I wrote the arrangement and then I put it aside for a few months. And then one night at, like, I want to say 2 a.m., I took off my glasses, I put it in front of my keyboard, and hunched over, I sight read it. Not call myself anywhere near a professional pianist. So the actual piece on the album, I think, is maybe 2 minutes or something. But me playing through it took 7.5 minutes, to give you an idea of, you know, it is the realest performance I've ever given. So probably my best one too, you know. Because
it's super authentic.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, it's my most authentic performance. You'll never hear a more authentic Mark Bennis performance than that choir playthrough.
That's really funny. And that actually brings up a question that I wanted to talk with you about, because there are so many dialogue trees as you're talking to these characters trying to solve the cases. And so how did you accommodate that, you know, the length of time that it could take? I mean, it must have been a real challenge to create stems and themes that could loop and not get, like, really tedious.
Yeah, that was definitely a big issue or thing we had to solve, you know, when we were approaching the music, because also there's also so many locations. You know, if I wrote a theme for every single backdrop, it would be, you know, over 2 hours of music, something even more insane than what I had to do in the first place. So a lot of it was about efficiency, and we ended up creating what we internally called a jukebox system, which is maybe not the most appropriate name for it, but it was essentially a system where we have a jukebox of tracks, and for certain locations where we didn't write specific themes, we basically have this system randomly cycle through the jukebox tracks. So for the places that really needed unique music, we were like, okay, like Francisco, we can't just throw in a random piece out of five for the cathedral, you know, I have to do the arrangement. So the specific locations definitely have the character, but then we wanted to capture the feel of Lamplight City in these five pieces that, you know, could apply to a lot of locations.
Yeah, and they do, and it doesn't sound repetitive at all. Which
oh,
is
thank God!
because the way you textured the music, I mean, the instrumentation is just so interesting, and it doesn't get grating or annoying. I think this is less of a thing now, but it used to be, you know, you'd get sort of stuck in an area, and you'd have to listen to the same music over and over again, and it just wouldn't change, and it's like, please, can I just kill this guy and move on?
So. right, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's the beauty of where, you know, technology is heading these days. For Game Boy games and, you know, the old SNES games, like, memory budget was a huge issue. So, you know, those repetitive songs were out of necessity. And, you know, the challenge of making a, you know, a 15-second, 20-second loop as interesting as possible, you know, it's... Yeah, I wouldn't wish that upon many people. It's a challenge that, you know, previous composers have faced, and luckily now that we have so much more to work with, you know, we can create that more immersive atmosphere where you're not consciously thinking, when is this melody going to end? Because I've been there too.
Yep.
Sometimes with my own music.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, one of the things that makes New Britannia seem so alive is that you're not just limited to one, you know, tiny square mile of real estate to explore and houses and stuff. There are other neighborhoods too. So what did you do to kind of bring those to life or give them each their own unique musical identity?
That was a big part, especially when we were working on the prologue of the game, because it takes place in this borough called Chumley. And if you see the spelling of Chumley, you're going to think, how in the world is that pronounced correctly?
It's a British thing.
Yeah, it's a British thing, you know. But Chumley is one of the more, you know, low income kind of dingy areas of the city, and I wanted to touch upon that and make it seem like the neighborhood you want to avoid, you know, when you're walking through the city. And that was for I wrote like two tracks specifically with that idea, Night in the Chum and Slums of Chumley. And part of the idea was using a very interesting harmonic language. You know, I guess the harmonic language really overflows into the whole score, but using an unsettling tonality and harmony that isn't too familiar.
Thank you. that's very cool. And again, you know, it really does make you feel like you're really there and like it has its own identity, which is really, really interesting.
Right. Yeah. Especially for coming up with a harmonic language was a challenge, because for me, to really encapsulate the mystery, and I can't just do, you know, typical chord progressions like 1-5-6-4, like that's not going to fly in Lamplight City, you know, and really finding a language that I think fit the game was one of the most fun parts about it. You know, I get to write music that's hearkening back to some other composers and languages, you know, like Bernard Herrmann from Hitchcock films. You know, his language is something I absolutely adore. It's simultaneously accessible, but almost like confusing in that, you know, you don't know where he's going. You don't quite understand the nuances until you really dig in.
Oh yeah. And now I can totally hear that in the strings, because they do have that kind of aspect of like the strings in Psycho, and
yeah.
they're very tense, and you can tell there's danger around the corner, but you're not sure what it is. And
right. And I think part of that like harmonic language is saying, you know, instead of a major chord or a minor chord being your point of stability, what if you call your point of stability something totally different, you know, like an augmented chord or like a minor major seventh in Psycho's opening. You know, it's like if you change your reference for stability, then you open up your language to so many different possibilities.
That is such a cool way to look at it. And
yeah.
You went even further afield. There's an orchestration of a Rachmaninoff prelude for piano.
Yeah.
How does that fit in the game?
Yeah, it plays in a wax cylinder player in one of the rooms in case one, and then again in a small cutscene. And for that, Francisco basically, you know, came to me and he said like, oh, you know, have you done any arrangements of, you know, classical sounding music that I can play on this wax cylinder? And I was like, oh, like I don't know if I have anything that fits. And then I was like, wait a second, I actually did a string arrangement of Rachmaninoff's Prelude back in college. And, you know, obviously the mock-up I did back then, you know, it's not quite up to par. So I said, okay, like why don't I take this arrangement I did from college? I'll redo the, you know, the mock-up, and, you know, I think it would fit. And I think it does serve as like almost grounding the music in something more tonal. You know, it when I hear it in the context of, you know, the track that plays in the background in Case One, which is Premature Inhumation. I'm almost forgetting my own music. But when you hear those two side by side, it's totally different languages. And it's almost as if like the music of Rachmaninoff is more real than the music I wrote. It's a interesting juxtaposition for sure.
Rachmaninoff was a great choice because it's such a throwback to music of an earlier time. I mean, it doesn't take you out of the era at all because it's such a romantic piece.
Yeah, yeah. And almost the idea of like drawing from romanticism, you know, it wasn't intentional, but it almost fits the whole story of the game in a way.
Yeah, definitely. And that whole concept of being buried alive, I mean, poor Madame Dupré, I mean, that was like everybody's fear in the 19th century. I mean, Hans Christian Andersen used to put a sign around his head, around his neck before he went to bed, said, "I'm not dead, I'm just sleeping."
Oh, maybe I need to find a sign for that. You're gonna give me a new fear.
Oh, no.
No, I'm just kidding.
There's another cue that I thought was just so interesting because, again, you know, listening to the soundtrack, it's a little bit of almost like an outlier. It's the Crimson Cat Rag. I mean, it must have been fun to have a chance to write a rag, right?
Yeah, it was for a small club in one of the cases, and it's subtle, but I wrote it as an arrangement of Down Among the Dead Men. So if you listen closely, it's actually the melody of Down Among the Dead Men just recontextualized into a rag.
Writing rags must present their own set of problems because they have a very specific structure.
Yeah, it was like probably one of the most structured pieces I had to, you know, really write for the soundtrack.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Down Among the Dead Men, we can circle back and talk about how you worked with the Folklore Guild.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, how did it occur to you to bring them in to work on this incredible arrangement of Down Among the Dead Men?
Yeah, I mean, first off, you know, the Folklore Guild absolutely did an incredible job on the arrangement. And part of me is I'm so happy I landed on the idea to really bring them in, because the way it started was I actually wanted just to do an a cappella arrangement of Down Among the Dead Men, with my idea being Tom Puffin, the choir director, is practicing this choir arrangement, and then at the end you hear the choir playing it with organ. That was my initial idea for the end credits, but to me it didn't really speak Lamplight City in the way that all the other tracks are, you know, creating this atmosphere. So it didn't quite have the right tone either. Like, you know, a major choir arrangement didn't quite fit it. So then I was thinking, okay, like, no, we can't do this. What if I do the choir with Down Among the Dead Men in minor? Like, maybe that'll fix the problem. Spoiler, it really didn't. Oh. So yeah, I worked through, you know, a few drafts of this, but then I eventually just made the decision, you know, like, Lamplight City, you know, has all these colors. The final track you hear in the game needs to include everything. So I almost wrote the track as a medley of sorts, in that I pull sections from a lot of the other tracks and stick them in and reorchestrate them or fit them into like the Down Among the Dead Men song. And to me, the song Down Among the Dead Men, with the lyrics and how they apply to, you know, basically someone, you know, drinking them to death, you know, which Miles nearly did. So we wanted to recontextualize the lyrics as well. So Francisco actually, you know, wrote new lyrics to the song, which I think fit the game so well. So he was definitely the person who said, you know, we need Down Among the Dead Men. And now it was up to me to really discover what form that was going to take.
Thank you.
I love how it's, like you say, it's like several different versions. And even mm-hmm. the solo piano version that's in the middle of the chorus mm-hmm. is just like another way to hear it, which is really, really interesting. And it does work because, you know, obviously Miles in his job runs up against or bumps into dead men mm-hmm. all the
yeah.
time. One of the things that makes it so interesting and makes him such an interesting character is the fact that, you know, he's trying to recover from his partner Bill's death mm-hmm. and he's taking a sleeping draft, which is kind of messing him up too. And so in a way, you're not really sure if you can like believe him. He's not like the most reliable or credible person necessarily. And so were you able to work that aspect of it into any of the themes that represent him or that come up as he's questioning witnesses?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that, you know, whole idea of, you know, him being, you know, him taking drugs, you know, to go to sleep and him being an alcoholic plays into that part of, you know, is Bill real? You know, is Bill part of his imagination or is he really hearing a ghost? And I think, you know, part of that, I wouldn't say I was necessarily, you know, directly, you know, hitting that, like, is Miles insane, you know, because I didn't want to quite focus on that too much, because to me, the story, I think, is more focused on, like, the relationship with Bill. But I do think, though, those kind of colors do pop up, like, in the Spectre Society, I have this finger symbol, which to me kind of represents the supernatural, the other world, and I try to use that as like a motif among like the more ethereal side of Lamplight City for sure.
The cues in the opium dens too,
right? Yeah,
really interesting and very exotic sounding.
Riding the Dragon, that one in particular, that one was one of the tougher ones to write, because, you know, I basically wrote it without strict bar lines and thinking more, you know, in a fluid structure, because, you know, the place is supposed to be very aloof, and that was definitely incorporates, I think, some of the most unique sounds and textures of any of the tracks, you know, with taiko drums and different plucked strings and all these interesting sounds I dug into my sample libraries for, essentially.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I was going to ask you how much of this was live and how much was samples and how you were able to like put everything together.
Yeah. So the only thing that's live is the choir and a few sounds I pulled for like Burning Desires, like a few like sampled sounds. But no, most of the instruments is actually samples. And that was definitely a budget consideration, since obviously the sound of Lamplight City would sound fantastic with a live orchestra, but realistically with the budget, you know, I had to say, can I do this with samples? And, you know, can I do it on a budget, you know, with samples, you know, because that's not even to say good samples are cheap, because they certainly are not. But I think I managed to find a good balance, in that rather than drawing upon 6 different string libraries and, you know, 3 different percussion libraries, I focused my palette on, here are my sample libraries that I'm going to write with. And I only really extended that for specific cases, like the organ or a specific hammered dulcimer that I found. But I think that's what helped with the consistency, because I think of, you know, if I was in a different part of my career and I had all the sample libraries in the world, you know, I don't know if Lamplight City would have the same consistency, because it really comes from using the same libraries and trying to do a lot with a little.
Yeah, definitely. And I didn't realize when I started the series and started talking with composers that sticking to the budget is a real challenge, because I guess I didn't really realize all that stuff that was involved. So when you're working with a very small studio, in fact, with this case, Grundislav Games, a studio of one person, making sure that you can make the most of your budget, I mean, that's super important.
Right, definitely. And like you said, Francisco is pretty much a sole developer, and he does so much of it. And part of me during the whole process is to do what he's created justice, you know, because the world alone can exist and feel so evocative. And, you know, I didn't want to overpromise myself and say, like, I'm going to get you the sound of a live orchestra under this budget. So obviously it needed a AAA budget to really accomplish that. So I really had to say, like, okay, like I'm not going to be able to get you that live orchestra sound, but I'm gonna get as close as possible with what I have. And I think it was a good middle ground, you know, rather than saying, you know, we're just going to do a string quartet, you know, or live record a very small ensemble and not get that breath from samples.
Yeah, definitely. And it absolutely fits the scale of the game with the graphics too. And so I think that was a really good call. How long did you have to write the music? I mean, I'm not really sure how long the game was in development.
Right. So I first met Francisco, I want to say a year and a half ago. I want to say in December at a local expo here in New York City, where both of us live, which is lucky, because also, while a lot of people do write music and develop and collaborate, you know, remotely, it's certainly possible. Being in the same city, the same room, and actually talking to each other, is there's something different about it. You know, you could be talking on Skype, you know, face to face, in quotes, but actually being in the same room and reading body language, it absolutely helps with the collaborative process. So, yeah, I'd met him at an expo, and that's when I first, you know, encountered the game. And I saw it, you know, had no music, the very rough sound effects, and none of the dialogue was recorded yet. And at that point, I was like really interested in it. And I had run into him later when I was volunteering at the 16-bit awards. It's a local award ceremony that we do in the city to celebrate developers here. And I had met him again at an after party. And I think I basically just said, like, oh, like, do you have a composer for Lamplight City? I remember your game from Expo. And he was like, no, I don't. And, you know, the rest is history. You know, I sent him some of my work, and, you know, he really believed that we could pull something off together.
Wow, that is such a great story.
Yeah.
I love it when that happens, and that it just kind of comes together in a really like organic way, which is just so cool and so good for everybody, and a lot less stressful than sending a demo and then waiting and not hearing in a lot of cases.
I think working with Francisco has been really, like, I consider myself so lucky. Like, not only has he been like really like a class model for how a developer should really treat freelancers and treat other composers. But he's actually been a very inspirational for some of my own stuff. You know, I came to the city about 2 years ago, and I was really set, like, oh, I'm just going to write music for games. You know, that's basically my calling. I'm probably not going to do any other parts of game development, but feeling such a big part of Francisco's development process, and I really got to see what he put into it, the commitment he really makes to making this game into reality, and it's inspired me to pursue some of my own development. So I've been moving into developing some of my own games, and big surprise, they're narrative adventure games. You know, they're I think Francisco has done so much more for me than just give me an outlet for my music. And I'm really grateful for him for that.
That's great. I mean, I've heard from my own experiences, mm-hmm. and then I've heard so many stories about how the community is just so welcoming and ready to help each other. And it's really yeah. fantastic, especially when you hear so much about how toxic the gaming community can be and that kind of thing. But there's the flip side, and it's not all like that. So, that's really great.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think what a lot of people come to the video game industry because they're passionate about games, but I really believe people stay for the other people, you know, the community. There's definitely toxicity related to the industry that we still need to fix, that we still have a long way to go. But I truly believe that the people who are the veterans in this industry, the people who are rising and will be the veterans in 10 to 20 years, have the right mindset of creating an inclusive and diverse industry. And I think it's only going to get better from here. And that's something I'm actually just really excited about. And I think having more voices, having more diverse games made by developers who are from all sorts of backgrounds, I think that's just going to make the industry so much more interesting and improve it in so many ways.
It will grow the audience too, because people can play yeah. games that either give themselves a chance to experience a culture or a world, or play as a character that they couldn't do in real life, or it makes them comfortable if they are from a different culture or an underrepresented sexuality or ethnic background. So I think it's a win-win for everybody.
Exactly. And I think that whole part is what I loved about Lamplight City, because Francisco portrays Addie, Maz's wife, as this very strong character, you know, arguably the strongest character in the game. You know, she does multiple jobs. She really keeps Miles together. And I think Francisco choosing to represent, an interracial relationship in such a positive and heartwarming way. Like, whenever I see their conversations, I love their relationship whenever I play through the game. And I think, like, creating that as, example of what games can and should be moving towards is great. You know, and in the same way that Francisco portrays Bill's sexuality as a gay man, and not as a character trait in quotes, because sometimes you see gay characters written to exist only because they're the gay character. And obviously Francisco doesn't do that. Bill's sexuality is just a part of him. It's not who he is, it's just an aspect that creates this very three-dimensional character. And the voice actors, I have to give a shout out to the voice actors. They all did such an incredible job, especially our two main characters that hear so much in the game, the banter between them. I was lucky enough to be involved in the dialogue recording process, and I have only the world to say about that.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, voice acting it's so hard. And to bring the character to life without anything and not being able to use your face, which, actors, they rely on that too as part of the package. So they did an amazing job. So, well, Mark, how can people track you down, on social or on your website?
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter as Mark_Venice. They can find me at my website, markvenice.com. Yeah, and Lamplight City soundtrack is on Bandcamp, Spotify, iTunes, anywhere you can find it.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. It's really been fun to talk with you. So thanks for spending some time.
Thank you so much.